is Monday, September 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the status of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein remains uncertain as he meets with the White House Chief of Staff. The President of the Maldives concedes defeat in the country's presidential election.
The population of the Maldives seems to have decisively rejected Yameen's move towards being a strong man and authoritarianism and against democracy.
And Muslim American women seek to represent the changing face of the United States in Congress. It's all ahead. There is uncertainty concerning the future of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. Some reports have suggested that he may be fired. Others have said he's discussed resigning. The news comes days after the New York Times reported that Rosenstein last year suggested secretly recording President Donald Trump and that he raised the idea of using the 25th Amendment to remove Trump from office for being unfit to govern. Rosenstein had denied the newspaper report last week. The deputy attorney general oversees the special counsel probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. Whether he's fired or resigns, it could affect who will take over the oversight of the Russia investigation. I'm joined by VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, who's at the United Nations, and also by national correspondent Jim Malone, who's here in the studio. Steve, what is known about today's White House meeting between Rosenstein and the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly?
Well, there was quite a bit of confusion. There were these flurry of reports that Rosenstein was headed over to the White House. He was either about to resign or about to be fired by the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly. And in the last few minutes, we've had a statement from the White House Press Secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who says he's not fired, and he will meet with the president on Thursday. But there's still this huge question mark hanging over everything. And it's possible that, of course, that Rosenstein could still submit his resignation, but it's unlikely that the president would accept it now before Thursday.
Yeah. Jim, you know, President Trump, of course, is at the United Nations at the moment for the General Assembly. But this meeting on Thursday, you know, that's sort of it seems a little bit ominous in a way.
Well, it harkens back to when Donald Trump was the host of the show The Apprentice, and they like to build a lot of drama. And one gets the sense that maybe what's going to go on here. The other interesting thing is Thursday is also the day for the hearing for Judge Kavanaugh to face his accuser, Christine Blasey Ford, on sexual harassment allegations. So I'm not sure what the connection there is, if anything, but all of this points to yet another chaotic and perhaps pivotal week here in Washington in the days ahead.
Yeah, Steve, speaking, I mean, Jim brought that up about the timing, because there has been, of course, so much controversy regarding President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. He's been accused of two sexual misconduct reports. He's denied that. You know, some political observers have said that this has been a Trump tactic to redirect public attention away from, you know, from one controversy to another.
Well, Sarah, what the White House wants right now, this is Monday, and until President Trump leaves New York on Thursday, well, they want the focus on what he's supposed to be doing here, which is being the chief diplomat, essentially, of the world. Because he's supposed to speak to the United Nations General Assembly tomorrow and the subsequent day to chair a session of the UN Security Council, because the United States holds the rotating gavel this month. And he wants to tout his accomplishments and then use a bully puppet to make comments about Iran, Syria, and perhaps North Korea before he leaves New York.
Jim, all this is kind of speculative at this point, but if Rosenstein were to leave at this point, what kind of impact would that have on the White House and the Trump administration?
We've already had statements from some Democrats that they would push for immediate hearings. They would fear that this would be one step toward trying to end, perhaps, the Russia probe or remove Robert Mueller, the special counsel. He reports directly to Rod Rosenstein. So I think there'll be a lot of apprehension in Washington that this sets up perhaps next steps. But even some Republicans have been warning the president to be cautious about this. We're about six weeks away now from midterm elections, where truly the future trajectory for the Trump presidency for the next 2 years will be decided. So everything that happens now is fraught with enormous political consequences.
Yeah, and also just think of the Justice Department. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has certainly not been one of Mr. Trump's most most favorite officials.
Well, look, he's got allies in the House of Representatives, conservative Republicans who have been basically campaigning against the Justice Department. They see the Russia probe as unwarranted and is born out of a bias in the Justice Department. The president has fanned those flames for about a year now. So, this could all be coming to a head now, or, some people have also urged him to wait till after the midterms to take action. But it looks like we're heading towards some sort of quicker resolution on at least Mr. Rosenstein's fate.
All right. Thanks very much, Jim. That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Here's some of the top news stories that are trending. Iran vows revenge on perpetrators of a terrorist attack. Russia will supply new S-300 missile defense systems to Syria. Hong Kong officially bans a pro-independence party, and North and South Carolina continue to deal with the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A group of scientists led by Johan Brox, an associate professor at the Australian National University, recently studied some fat molecules they had found on an ancient fossil. They say their studies provided evidence that allowed them to identify the fossil animal as a Dickinsonia and that it is the earliest known animal in the geological record. The scientists say the creature lived on Earth about 558 million years ago, which was about 20 million years before the so-called Cambrian explosion of modern animal life. Brox described this event as a time when complex animals and other life forms, like mollusks, worms, sponges, and arthropods, took over the fossil record. Brox and his colleagues described this primitive animal as being oval-shaped with rib-like structures along its body and measuring about 1.4 meters in length. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. The president of the Maldives has conceded defeat in Sunday's presidential election. We'll get some analysis. Well, at the United Nations today, President Donald Trump said he will hold a second summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un quite soon. I'm going back now to VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman, who is at the United Nations for these days of important meetings there. So, Steve, what did Trump say about this proposed or, future
right.
meeting with Kim Jong-un?
Well, when he was walking into the UN today and he was asked a question by reporters about North Korea and whether he would meet again with Kim Jong-un, he said that he certainly will. No timing announced. And subsequently, when we had Secretary of State Mike Pompeo over to the White House Press Filing Center late in the morning, he was asked about that. And said he's certain that it will happen and that he, Pompeo, will go to Pyongyang most likely before the end of the year to make arrangements for that second summit.
Mm. Well, now, but of course, there's still the contentious issue of North Korea's nuclear program. Did Pompeo speak about that at all?
Yes, he did. He was quizzed by a number of reporters, including myself, about that. And he still says that the goal is the complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But when he is asked what steps have been taken or that the United States wants to see taken before there is a second summit, he avoided directly answering that, said negotiations are going on. A lot of the stuff that's happening, you do not know about it. And he's not going to talk about the state of those negotiations. But it's obviously been a very sensitive matter that despite the declaration made by Kim, and also whether the United States and North Korea have very different definitions of denuclearization, that there hasn't been any significant concrete steps taken along that line yet.
Has South Korea commented on this yet?
Well, as you know, the South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, just spent 3 days in Pyongyang last week. And there was also mention of denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula. And in about an hour or so, President Moon will be speaking with President Trump here. So hopefully after that, we'll get a little bit of an indication of what progress may have been made. And President Trump also saying that he received another letter from Kim Jong-un and that the North Korean leader had expressed a desire to meet again.
Yeah, it's been interesting that Trump in the past has, you know, he referred to Kim Jong-un as, you know, Rocket Man, and yet then they met. And since then, Trump has says that the two of them have a good personal relationship.
Correct. Well, we've also heard that sort of language describe his relationship with Xi Jinping, the leader of China. But in the case of both China and North Korea, the United States has been taking various measures. The sanctions are still in place on North Korea, and there are mounting tariffs. You could say we're almost in a trade war with Beijing, despite the professed good relationship with the Chinese leader. So, yeah, a couple of different tracks here where the president talks about the wonderful relationship, but there are obvious problems. And we also have to say that between North Korea and the United States, there is no diplomatic relationship. There never has been. So he can have a great relationship with the leader of this country, but the fact is there are these heavy sanctions on North Korea by the United States and the United Nations, and there is no diplomatic relationship.
Well, Pompeo spoke at a news conference that took place today alongside National Security Advisor John Bolton and U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley.
Right.
What were some of the other issues that they spoke about?
Well, I think North Korea did dominate that. There was a question or two about Rosenstein. Nikki Haley said that she had no recollection of invoking Article 25, this process to remove a president from power, from ever being discussed among cabinet officials. And then Pompeo chimed in and said you could add him as another senior official who had never heard any such discussion going on. They also wanted to tout what they see are the major accomplishments of this administration in the past year since President Trump was here last. And there's quite a bit of focus, of course, on this counter-narcotics issue, President Trump speaking at a session devoted to that earlier in the day.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Steve. That's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. The president of Maldives has conceded defeat in Sunday's presidential election. Abdullah Yameen said in a televised address Monday, "I accept the defeat." And he added he would enable a smooth transition for opposition leader Ibrahim Mohamed Salih. Salih declared victory early Monday, hours ahead of Yameen's concession. The Election Commission's provincial results has Salih winning 58.3% of the votes. Official results will not be released until the end of the month. The 56-year-old Salih became the Maldivian Democratic Party's standard bearer after party leader and former president Mohamed Nasheed went into exile in Sri Lanka.
This is a moment of happiness. This is a moment of hope. This is a moment of history. For many of us, this has been a difficult journey, a journey that has led to a prison cell or years in exile. It's been a journey that led to a complete politicization and breakdown of public institutions. It's been a journey that has ended at the ballot box because the people willed it. The will of people has spoken, and it has spoken decisively for change.
Yameen imposed a state of emergency in February to overturn a Supreme Court decision to throw out the convictions of 9 opposition leaders, including Nasheed, the country's first democratically elected president. Daniel Brewster is a visiting fellow at the Strategic and Defense Studies Center at the Australian National University. He tells International Edition's Victor Beattie the election result was remarkable.
And I don't think I've seen anyone predicting it. It was assumed, I think, by everyone watching the election that it was going to be a rigged election, and that would have been very much consistent with Yameen's past practice.
What was the message sent by the voters?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit too early to see what exactly was the biggest driving forces. Certainly from an international perspective, the population of the Maldives seems to have decisively rejected Yameen's move towards being a strong man and authoritarianism and against democracy. The big question, I think, is to what extent the China factor played a role in this victory, and I think we'll have to look at that in coming days.
What do you mean by that?
The current president, or the president who we believe has lost this election, was seen to have become very, very close to China over the last 5 years, including incurring significant indebtedness to China, and there was a view that he was really China's man in the region.
What is this going to do for human rights in the Maldives?
You can only assume that the new government will be far more liberal and more democratically inclined compared with the old one. The new government, the Maldivian Democratic Party, was formed around a little less than 20 years ago and contested the country's first democratic elections in the early 2000s. And the period in which the MDP ruled was seen as much more of a liberal and democratic regime compared with any other governments.
Is this good news for Sri Lanka and India?
It's certainly good news for India, and in fact good news for the United States and Australia in terms of seeing China's influence in the region rather limited. I have to say, you have to see this election result in the context of a series of election results in countries like Sri Lanka and Myanmar, and more recently in Malaysia, when democratic elections turned out regimes that were becoming authoritarian and being seen as very, very close to China. And you know, you could easily see this as part of potentially a bit of a regional reaction to some of the practices of China in the region.
Daniel Brewster, a visiting fellow at the Strategic and Defense Studies Center at the Australian National University. In a statement, the U.S. congratulated the people of the Maldives for peacefully raising their democratic voices to determine the future of their country. It urged calm and respect for the will of the people. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Depending on the outcome of the November midterm elections, the U.S. House of Representatives is likely to welcome the first 2 Muslim American women into the chamber as lawmakers. They join Indiana Congressman Andre Carson as members of the national government, representing an often misunderstood and marginalized faith. As VOA's Kane Faraba reports, the candidates represent the changing face of the U.S. Congress in a country with a changing religious and ethnic makeup.
It started in Michigan.
But I want to thank all of you so much. This is a lot of hard work.
Did you win?
Yes.
And continued in Minnesota.
Because we're going to Washington, everyone!
And neither Ilhan Omar nor Rashida Tlaib believe it will end in Washington, D.C.
This win would mean so much more than just a seat in Congress. It is a powerful message.
A message primary election voters in their districts delivered in August, that a Muslim American woman is ready to represent them in Congress, even at a time of increased hostility towards their faith.
I had one of my campaign managers leave a nonprofit organization. The woman said, you know, really sorry to see you leave. And Diana said, oh, don't worry about me. I'm going to actually go work for the first Muslim woman ever elected in the Michigan legislature. I'm super excited. And she said, they're in our government.
And to see, you know, these women potentially elected to the Congress of the United States is a huge statement.
Alvin Tillery says while the election wins of both women are not surprising in the liberal districts they represent, they are part of a new wave of immigration. Muslims represent just over 1% of the U.S. population, but it is the fastest growing religion on earth. The Pew Research Center says by 2040, Islam will be the second largest religion in the U.S., and Omar and Tlaib represent the face of that changing population.
This is the quintessentially American story. It's the story of, you know, Irish immigrants and Italian immigrants, Polish immigrants. It's just playing out with a different religion and ethnicities, and that's what America is supposed to be about.
Tlaib, the daughter of Palestinian immigrants, was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan. Omar was born in Somalia, but fled to a refugee camp in Kenya before joining the large Somali community in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Welcome to the House of Representatives.
While both come from families shaped by war and have faced hostility toward their religion on both sides of the political aisle, they represent a progressive wing of the Democratic Party that hopes to take control of the U.S. House in the November midterm elections, contests both women still have to win. Tlaib is running unopposed, and while Omar faces opposition from a Republican challenger, she is likely to win. But Tillery says their biggest challenge isn't winning elections, it's meeting the expectations of voters and the Muslim American community.
So there will be, in essence, a greater burden on them because of their identities and because of the historic change that they represent. They'll have a larger portfolio and a larger set of expectations than the normal freshman congressperson.
A Congress that will tackle many tough issues, including U.S. border security, immigration, and election integrity. Issues both Tlaib and Omar hope to have an opportunity to weigh in on when the next Congress convenes in January. Kane Faraba, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
Thank you, Kane. Well, Facebook has hired Ajit Mohan of the Indian streaming service Hotstar to run its India division. In the midst of accusations from the Indian government that the company's WhatsApp messaging service has helped trigger mob violence, Mohan has been CEO of Hotstar since 2016, according to his LinkedIn profile. Mohan's appointment comes during a period of intense criticism from the Indian government towards the social media giant. False messages about child kidnappers circulated anonymously on WhatsApp have triggered violent mobs that beat and kill bystanders suspected of being involved in crime several times during the past year. The Indian government has warned Facebook it will treat the company as a legal abettor to violence if it does not develop tools to better combat the spread of false information. That is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.